They're the ones that build like the Centaur rockets and things like that. You know, they build the rockets like forever. But this particular group of rockets that they bought, they turned around and sold them to Orbital Science at the time, now called Orbital ATK. And let me drop it. I know I'm going to time it out. So they install them into the Antares rocket to launch their Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. But the NK-33, or now called AJ-26, failed, and that's what blew up. Orbital said, that's it, no more of these. In fact, they dropped. When ATK got involved with Orbital, they told Aerojet, goodbye, we don't want anything to do with you right now. You know, we ain't mad at you, but we don't want your rocket engines. So they went out themselves and they purchased more rocket engines from Russia, and these are called the 181s. I can give you the history of them things too, but they're derivative of another type of engine from Russia, actually called the 191s. But these are very supposedly going to be very reliable rocket engines. So they're taking two of them and they're putting them in the back of Antares, just like they had the two NK-33s that blew up. It's a close fit. That's why they chose the 181. So they're taking the RD-181s and they're putting them into the Antares rocket. It's a little different than the 180s. The 180s are the ones that are launched by the Atlas rockets down in Florida and also from California. Yeah, well, the 181, big honking rocket, and that's the one that has these two nozzles coming out, two exhausts. So they both look like they have two exhausts, but the difference is Atlas rocket is basically a bigger rocket, a lot more thrust, like, I don't know, 700,000 pounds of thrust or something, where these new ones that Orbital is using for Antares are, you know, half that thrust, but they're putting two of them together, so they're getting probably, 500,000-600,000 pounds of thrust out of it to launch a Cygnus spacecraft up to the space station. So that's pretty much it. And I got your email, by the way, about all the trillions of stars. Back to you, back to Dick.
Either I'm confused or you are confused, guys. I'm talking about Ukraine, I'm not talking about Russia. Forget about Russia. Russia's story is true. That's what you say. Now, Ukraine is replacing Russia. And Antares doesn't use Russian engine. It used Ukrainian made. And that's the difference. And to exchange.
Okay, for coming at the master, Paul.
Yeah, I grew up with the USSR. To me, anything over there is Russia. So, I get you. You know, I mean, I always say Russia is launching another rocket from Russia. Oh, they don't launch it from Russia anymore. They launch it from Kazakhstan. I get it, Wesley. Ukraine launches certain rockets, makes a certain kind of rockets, and actually Russia wants to get away from their rockets. Here's another speech. To do that, you know, in other words, Russia's got this conflict going with Ukraine. I get that. So now they want to get away from theirs. So what they're doing there is they've invented or they're developing the Angara. They call it the Angara rocket. And the Angara rocket is completely different rockets, completely different engines. Everything's made in-house from Russia. And they're even going to launch it from Russian soil. And that's why they built Baskochny out in there. They spent, I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars on this place, out in the middle of nowhere, eastern Russia, 4,000 miles away from Moscow. So, I think I get what Wesley's saying. He wants me to, he's right, you know, we should separate the difference between all these different countries. To me, they were all one. Back to you, Dick.
Let me have another comment. Well, the difference is made in the United States is made in Canada. So forget about the United States. Everything is North America. I mean, nonsense, guys. Nonsense. Okay. Here's the story. Ukraine was a rocket engine maker, but after the split, Russia decided that they want to take care of their own engines, and they promote the Ukrainian version, which they had a few of them. In other words, the former Soviet Union had things done in different countries that belonged, but after Perestroika, they had a big problem. Now, what is happening is Americans find out that why should we order the engines from Russia if we can work with Ukraine, and Ukraine is almost part of European Union, and they don't really try to keep up with the late 1970s concept. Even though that Russia is giving a grief in Donetsk and Lugansk right now, it's trying to disturb the economy of Ukraine. The Ukraine is a different country, and Ukraine is now working with the United States of America. So we assume that from now, engines that were made in Russia would be made in Ukraine, and it would be different engines. And to actually, and Antares is the example of it.
Any further comment, Paul? Go ahead.
No, no. I have a hard time following the Russian politics. I have a hard time following the American politics. I don't, you know. All I want to know is it a full fuel cycle engine, or, you know, what kind of engine it is, how many horsepower is it, where they, you know, are we making them here, or are we getting them from somewhere else now? I like the idea that we can make them here, and we have a company here called Blue Origin, and Blue Origin is now making our big engines. They call the BE-4. They're going to be liquid methane engines, liquid oxygen engines. They're well on the way. They've tested them, and they're going to use them not only on their own rocket called the New Glenn, but I've talked about this group before, United Launch Alliance, which is nothing but Boeing and Lockheed. They keep them together. They're the ones that launch these big rockets, these Atlas V rockets for NASA. Within a couple of years, they're not only going to be putting these BE-4 rockets on their own rockets, but Boeing is developing a new rocket called Vulcan. The Vulcan rocket is going to have these BE-4 rockets. So, again, we're going to be continuing to make our own rockets, but our own engines are going to be supplied by Blue Origin. So, that's what I like to see. Anyway, then we won't have to worry about the Russians, the Ukraine. We won't have to worry about Kazakhstan or anybody else. Back to you there.
Is the BE-4 currently under development, or is it essentially developed and it's just ironing out the production problems? Paul, what do you think, K2RIW?
It's well in the development. It's probably about 4 years in, and they're ahead of Aerojet. Aerojet is making their own large engine, and to replace, you know, they wanted the contract with Boeing. Boeing's leader, a fellow named Bruno, he sat down with the owner of Blue Origin. His name is Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon.com, and he's the one building, you know, all these rockets for Blue Origin. He sat down with them, and he signed a deal. Right now, it's going to be the BE-4 for the new Vulcan rocket, which will eventually replace the Atlas rocket. And you know, they're leaving Aerojet on the table in case they have problems with the development of the BE-4, but right now there's no problems. They're testing them out in West Texas. So, it is. They're going to be very, very good from what I read. So it's under development for quite a few years, and they're ahead of Aerojet. Aerojet is a company that's been around for, I don't know, three decades, like 30 years, probably more. And they're beating them out, and it's a new company called Blue Origin. Back to you, Jeff.
Jeff Bezos. Bezos. He's a mover and a shaker, isn't he, Paul? I guess he's made his fortune in his original business, and now he's branching out into other things. And so he and, can't think of the other guy's name, real rich man who's doing a lot of space work. You know who I'm talking about, Paul, go ahead.
Elon Musk. You know, he's the one with the Falcon 9, and eventually he's going to develop bigger and better rockets. We talked about that a week or two ago. And he's involved with other companies. He, you know, Elon Musk makes the Tesla automobile. He's in charge of Solar City, all the solar panels going across America. And he started off in PayPal, sold PayPal, and parlayed that into SpaceX. And Jeff Bezos is another billionaire that's got this thing going called Blue Origin. And he's a stone's throw away from having a crew being put on suborbital flights called the New Shepard out in Texas. You know, they'll probably launch out of New Mexico or Texas. So that's just probably a year and a half, 2 years away before you start to see paying passengers on that thing. Now he's developing the new rocket, which will go orbital, called the New Glenn, and it's almost as big as the Saturn V, and that will be launched out of Florida. So you got all these billionaires. Another one, I'm dropping, called Paul Allen. He started Microsoft. He was involved with Bill Gates. Now he's taken his fortune and he's put it into a couple of things. He built the Paul Allen Array. I don't know how many, probably 100 of these dish antennas. He's out looking for little green men. But he's got this other project called Strato launched, and that's going to be this big plane. Again, we've talked about that before, and that biggest wingspan ever of any plane. And he'll be launching rockets eventually from that to low Earth orbit. So you got that guy. And now you got another guy called Beck. Get his first name. And he's probably a couple of months away from launching his first rocket. Let me drop it. From New Zealand, the North Island of New Zealand. He set up a built his own launch complex and everything. And he's probably a month or two away from launching they call it the Electron rocket. And that will be going up very shortly. And once that gets into high development, he expects to have maybe 50 launches per year from that complex. And, you know, all small stuff like, you know, maybe 500 kilograms of weight into low Earth orbit. I'm sure there's a couple more I'm missing, but it's good you got all these rich guys involved with this. You know, they really move fast. Back to you, Dick.
Any chance that Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Paul Allen or Mr. Beck will join forces on any of these efforts, or are they all in friendly competition with each other? How do you see that, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
I just see right now friendly competition. I didn't even think of it, but I guess it's possible that, you know, they might join up together. Oh, I thought of another guy, Bigelow. He's got that. He's building those inflatable modules down in Las Vegas. He's doing that. And now there's a lot of private companies that Sierra Nevada launch company. They're building a Dream Chaser and all, but you know, they're kind of like the corporation type of thing. As far as all these rich individuals, I think that's about it. Might have missed somebody. Let's see, we had Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Bigelow, Beck. Beck comes out of New Zealand, but spent some time in the United States. By the way, he eventually wants to launch some rockets out of the United States as well, so that should be good. The reason they call out the Electron rocket, by the way, that's instead of running turbo pumps to run the liquid oxygen and liquid fuel into the combustion chamber, he's got these 50 horsepower motors hooked up to lithium batteries, and he's going to drive the turbo pumps with that to launch his rockets. That's pretty cool. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yeah, there's one other guy we're talking about here with reference to flights. Virgin Atlantic, I can't think of his name. He's making spacecraft that are going to be taking people into suborbital flights. So right now, for the rich people who want to take suborbital flights, there's going to be a number of companies supplying that service, aren't there, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, how could I forget about Richard Branson? Yeah, he does Virgin Galactic. Same guy that does Virgin on the airplanes. Got all those airplanes. Virgin, and then there's Virgin Mobile, involved with the telephones. But yeah, his thing now is trying to launch Spaceship 2, which will carry eventually, I believe, 6 passengers and a crew of 2. And then, you know, unfortunately, he had that mishap a couple of years ago when they were testing out Spaceship 1, and actually they called it Spaceship 2. Spaceship 2, first version, and it blew up in flight. But now they got the second one, and it's already gone for some test. They put it on the bottom of White Knight, and they carried it up into the atmosphere, brought it back. So probably within a month or two, maybe we'll see a test where they drop it from White Knight and land it I think he's out in Edwards Air Force Base. So yeah, I forgot about him. Then there's a couple of small guys. One guy, I don't know if he's that small, but he's developed a company called Moon Express. He's all gung-ho. Another guy that I think he went broke. Let me drop it. Firefly. They had plans on launching out of Cape Canaveral. That's why it doesn't pay to remember too many of these guys, because some of them go on their way, so they go away. There was Armadillo. They're gone. So some of them go away. I try to remember the bigger ones. But I think Moon Express is going to make it. They don't have any launch vehicles. He's building a spacecraft that will be able to land on the moon. He hopes to launch it by the end of 2017. Using the Electron rocket, he's got a contract with Beck to launch out of New Zealand. So he wants to go to the moon and win the Google Prize. Try to get a hold of $20 million that way. Back to you, Dick.
Google prize of $20 million. Wow. Yeah, I vaguely remember that. So right now, Paul, there are a number of companies that will take a rich person he wants it bad enough, into a suborbital flight. And I guess we've got a number of organizations that are looking forward to taking people really into orbit and maybe beyond. So right now, how many of these guys are claiming in the next few years suborbital passengers, meaning civilians, and how many are claiming orbital passengers and beyond civilians? Roughly how many of each of those, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Okay, let's go with passages. We talked about Virgin Galactic, crew of two, passengers, I believe six, which they call it space station, spaceship two. By the way, they have another, Virgin Galactic has another group called Launcher. They want to launch, just call the Launcher. They're going to launch small satellites and try to develop that. And, so he's got other interests. He's going to drop that thing from a 747 that he owns. And he's going to send small satellites into space. But people-wise, he's got the spaceship, too. There's another one called made by X-Corps. X-Corps is developing a spacecraft called Lynx. Now, Lynx is a two-person. You're going to have a pilot and you're going to have a passenger. You sit side by side, not behind one another. And you take off with four rockets. It's got like a rubbery fuel to it. They said it's like a rubber tire type of density to it. And it's going to launch from a runway. And then land on a runway, and again, suborbital. And Spaceship 2 is also suborbital. Let me drop it. Now you've got Jeff Bezos with New Shepard. New Shepard, he is very successful. He has launched the same rocket to suborbital space and landed it vertically five different times. It's come back five different times. And each time he does better and better what he's doing. The last time he ran an abort test to see, theoretically if the booster blew up, would the people be saved? And that worked out okay. The spacecraft came down on parachutes and landed. So that's New Shepard, again, suborbital. So we did all the suborbital ones, as far as I know. The orbital flights, again, by the same two people. SpaceX isn't really into that yet. They want to send people to Mars. Let me drop it. Yeah, we're going to forget about them. You said within the next couple of years, next 3 or 4 years, possibilities. I would say 2019, you will probably see the first flight of the New Glenn. New Glenn is, again, by orbital. New Origin, Jeff Bezos. He's developing a rocket big enough to go into orbit to carry people. That's his goal, bring some passengers up. And maybe eventually dock with a private space station that maybe Bigelow will put up there. He wants to put up these expandable B-330 expandable space stations. You can dock them together. You'll have as much room as the International Space Station if he does that. So he wants companies to come up and dock with him. So I could see New Glenn doing that. So quite a bit. Any more orbital people? Let me drop it. Now, you got a barn one. Got Skylon being developed, but I don't see that until probably in the mid-2020s. Skylon's being developed. A company in England is developing the engines, and they think they got a good engine going, but they haven't funding That's about it for now, Dick. Probably missing somebody. European Space Agency. I don't think they have anything. Everything's satellites going out of French Guiana, out of South America. Back to you, Dick. WS-20.
It's possible that Virgin Atlantic, Richard Branson, may have done some of his flights or landing at Edwards Air Force Base, but I think the majority of his operation is out of Mojave Airport, which is about 10 or 15 miles north of Edwards. I've been there, the Mojave, and I saw some of the panels on the wall indicating his operation. So these rich people who want to do suborbital flights or orbital flights, these people are going to have to pay numbers that approach a good fraction of $1 million, aren't they, Paul? And I presume NASA is not proposing to bring any civilians up to the space station anymore, is my guess. WS2N, KQRIW.
No, they never had plans of doing that. Closest thing, I guess, would have been the teacher in space. But, no paid passengers. You know, who was it? John Denver, the singer. He wanted NASA to allow him to go up, and then he was gonna pay the Soviets to go up. But then it didn't look good because he has all these pro-American songs. I think he backed out of that. But he wanted to go. But yeah, no, any of the six passengers that have gone to the International Space Station have paid and gone through Russia on the Soyuz spacecraft up to the space station. And then money-wise, yeah, well, I've heard numbers like $200,000 for Virgin Galactic for Spaceship Two. I've heard $100,000 for the Lynx spacecraft with the X-Core. And then there's another company called Paragon. Now they're going under the name Worldview, you know, a subsidiary of Paragon. Paragon is not quite rocket flight. Let me drop it. But it is balloon flight. You know, they're going to blow up these big helium balloons and take you up to, you know, 100,000 feet or something, which is high. And, you know, you get to see the curvature of the Earth. You're in an enclosed, I'll call it a capsule, completely enclosed with six other people. There'll be a bathroom there. You could have some hors d'oeuvres or something. This is the way they're advertising it. And you look around for, you know, 4 or 5 hours, and when it's time to come to an end, you're cut loose from, this capsule is cut loose from the balloon. You start heading down, and not a parachute that opens up, but one of these big parasail things, you know, which, you know, you're able to guide, you know, not you, but you're going to have two people on board that are able to guide this thing. Let me drop it. And you'll be able to float all the way down to the earth, and you have these skis on the bottom of the this module, and you'll slide into a landing on Earth, and you pay a lot less. I think that's the $60,000 or $70,000 crowd. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to very high altitude balloon flights, what's the name of the adventurer in the last year or two who bailed out at something like 115,000 feet and did a free fall and broke the speed of sound on the free fall? What's his name, Paul? And how long ago did he do that?
Yeah, he went up with this Paragon company. That's, you know, that's the same company that's going to develop this for people. And he was, and I think, one of the developers of Google. that did that, and then there was another guy before him, and he was advertising Red Bull. He comes out of Sweden or someplace. I forget where, some foreign country. But he did it, and then this guy broke his record. And they go all the way up in a balloon, and then they jump out of the balloon and fly like Superman all the way down, and eventually they open up their parachutes. It's very tricky, they said, because you're in rarefied air, and you have a tendency to start spinning, and somehow you got to be able to correct for that. That happened with the first guy. That he did probably in the late 1950s or something, maybe. And that guy, he went up, they set him up, and I forget his name. Back to you, Dick.
But the most recent guy who successfully jumped and broke the sound barrier, I wish we could remember his name. You and I would recognize it right away if we could think of his name. And he's probably about as high as you can jump and still be safe. You jump any higher than that, if you had a way of getting there, you eventually build up such a velocity that when you eventually hit the air, you're going to get a lot of heating. Eventually, you become a meteor. Too bad we can't think of his name, Paul. K2LAW.
Baumgartner? Google. I hope somebody said something. Felix Baumgartner?
Felix Baumgartner. That sounds about right. Does it sound right to you, Paul? Felix Baumgartner?
I thought he was the guy I was thinking about. That was advertising for Red Bull or something. And all kinds of commercial advertising companies involved with him. Felix. I don't know. I'll find him on the computer, but I thought the guy from Google had a different name.
Anybody remember any of the names of the two guys who jumped from a balloon above 100,000 feet?
To Eustace?
Give us a little more transmission before you start talking. We keep missing the beginning of your conversation. I heard Eustace. I don't know what that means.
I think it was Alan Eustace is the other one. This is K1MJM.
I don't recognize that name, Mike. Do you recognize it, Paul?
That rings a bell, but I don't know if it was from that incident. I can put it on my computer, take me a minute, but was he from Google, Mike? No, I'm just trying to remember which was which. It's one or the other. Another guy was the first guy. Before the Google guy, his last name began with a B, and I thought his first name was Felix, so that's why I think it's that guy. And but the second guy, I don't remember. And they kept it quiet like forever. He didn't tell anybody what he was doing for like a year or two. And when he came down, one of the astronauts, not Scott Kelly, but Mark Kelly, the brother, the guy that did not do the one-year flight, he did other flights, was there to advise, and he saw him land. He gave a lot of advice to, I believe it was Paragon that put this guy up there. But no, I'll find a guy on the computer if somebody already has it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, and he did do some spinning on the way down, but managed to keep it from becoming a high velocity spin. I guess, in theory, you could start spinning fast enough that you could become unconscious or even become injured. And I wonder if you can aim your hands just right to stop the spin, or is there something more complicated going on when you're going very fast through very thin air? And if you had to develop some kind of a piece of hardware to stop the spin, that doesn't sound easy. But I wonder if anyone's ever done a calculation as to what is the maximum altitude a man can bail out and still be safe. Because eventually at some altitude, you're going to hit a high enough velocity that when you hit the air, you're going to have a significant amount of heating. You almost become a meteor. And I think he was above the speed of sound for a good 30 seconds or maybe a minute or so, it seemed to me, when I watched that YouTube video of him returning to Earth. K2RIW, anyone else want to make some comments on all of the above?
The name of that book wife has a younger part of her life and how she got involved with these people and who the guy was behind the money guy behind this project and what it all entailed and how they were going to do it and get into ecology and everything. It's an amazing book on what went on. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, does the name of the book, 2 Years and 2 Minutes, does that represent the amount of time that she was able to spend in the biodome, even though they were getting down to like 10 or 15% of oxygen? Oh, you, Paul?
Yeah, well, yeah. It was supposed to be 2 years, and actually she got to 2 years, and they were all, you know, in their flight suits. They look like flight suits as they're getting ready to leave, and outside the biodome, they had all this, everything set up, you know, they were probably going to have a big, getting ready for a big affair, you know, as these people come out, and the story goes is, I think that it was Jean Goodall, you know, one of these environmental people, she's going on, and wouldn't shut up, and, you know, and it just dragged on and on. The speech was going on, and she wanted to get out exactly two years, and it went on a couple more minutes because of the speech. You know, that's how they come up with the name of the book. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, because the plants were not converting oxygen fast enough, and they were running low, I think they had to periodically open a port somewhere to suck in air from the outside. They were also being contaminated by the outgassing of the concrete, which wasn't properly cured on the floor. And I think the swamp plants were not being treated quite right. And so the planning of such a mission is a lot more complicated than that first meets the eye. And maybe the total volume of their biodome and the number of plants inside might not have been appropriate for 8 human beings continuously breathing. A human being that's alive is continuously metabolizing at the rate of 130 watts. That's 450 BTU per hour. The raw materials have to be coming into your body as food, water, and oxygen to maintain 24/7 130 watts of power generation. That's what a living human being does. And 8 of those, I think they needed a couple of acres of plants. I don't think the biodome was big enough, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
As many acres. Down in Arizona, you can still go see it. It's now being operated by a college out there. But it's supposed to be quite a few acres. And you read what went into this. And the water that it was, you know, they made their own little ocean of fish and they had their own desert savannas, and it just, you know, you read the book, it's unbelievable what went into this massive place, and it's so big that, you know, if you think about it, it's so heavy, if you were to cut it loose and try to launch this thing into space, I think we've been launching rockets since, what, the late 1950s, if you took all the rockets that we've all of Earth has ever launched and put them together, you'd never get this thing off the ground. So, you know, to try to get anything close to this, you know, a different way, but trying to sustain even 8 people for a long distance flight to Mars and eventually landing on Mars and doing the same thing. Sounds difficult. At least they had animals here. They were eating chickens and stuff. You know, what are you going to get to Mars? You know, you're going to grow. What are you going to grow? Mushrooms? I don't even like mushrooms. Back either.
Yeah, Mars has only a small fraction, like 43% of the solar radiation the Earth has. No atmosphere. A lot less gravity. No ionosphere. I mean, the movie The Martian, Neil deGrasse Tyson has a YouTube video telling you the 30 or so errors that were in that movie, things that were not real. In the movie, 2 Years and 2 Months, I mean, the movie, the book, 2 Years and 2 Months, did it describe some of the errors, some of the things that went wrong, like not enough pure water, maybe, or not enough oxygen in the air, and they had to occasionally vent to the outside? Did the book indicate any of those errors, Paul, or did the book only tell you the good news, so to speak? WS2N, K2RAW.
It's maybe also the good news, but it does bring up some points, you know. Especially at the end, you know, they'll tell you some of the things that went wrong. But yeah, I think it's 2 Years and 2 Minutes, I believe, is the name of the book. And some of the libraries don't have that book. For some reason, it wasn't all that popular, I guess. I don't know. I know somebody tried to get it, and they had to order it from their library. But it's been around a long time. It's not something that just came out recently. So they tell you some of the problems. It's been a while since I read it. I've read all the articles regarding the biosphere, so I'm kind of confused. I don't remember how detailed they got in describing the problems. Like you said, bringing in oxygen and things like that. You know, things that they had to basically cheat a little here and there on. I think they kind of like touch on that. Back to you.
In the conclusion, Paul, do you remember whether or not Jane Poynter said these are the mistakes we made? We needed 50% more area. We needed more of these kind of plants. We needed more of these kind of animals. We needed less of these animals. In the case of putting animals in there, I see that as a problem, because the animals are going to be literally eating the food and the oxygen that the people need. So to put a whole lot of plants in there, I can see. Other than putting some animals in there that you can eat, a couple of acres of land with very efficient agriculture, I think, can maintain a human being. But forget about the fact, let me drop it. Yeah, you're growing your food on that acre or two of land, but you got continuous rain coming in from the outside, you got continuous air coming in from the outside universe, so to speak. It's not a closed system. It's a closed chunk of land, but there's a lot of stuff coming in and coming out of your chunk of land that you may not have to figure on. You look at a tree, and a tree contains thousands of pounds of wood, and the majority of that wood is made out of carbon. And where did the carbon come from? The carbon dioxide that was in the air. The total number of cubic meters of air that's required to get enough carbon to build the wood of the tree is huge. You couldn't grow a tree like that in a biosphere, I don't think. So did she indicate that if she was doing it again, we need 50% more of this and 50% less of that? Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
She did evaluations of you know, what was going on there. But, you know, not in the numbers. Like, I know what you're thinking. If you take all the that was involved with that project and realize, you know, none of the energy that was being produced inside, you know, everything that was being produced inside was really being recycled, you know, especially for the first year. I think that was quite an accomplishment. It was after the first year, I think they started to run problems with the oxygen levels and all of that. They even got lightheaded. You know, they describe all of that. It's well worth reading. So now, it was a sealed system. That whole floor was sealed, so it's not like things were coming from underground. It was supposed to be a completely sealed system. Top, you know, walls,
You're saying it really was self-sustaining for the first year? I mean, if you get past a few months and the system is not running down, you would think it would last forever. I'm amazed it could last a year, and then the second year they got into trouble. Did they have instrumentation so that they could, if they got lightheaded, you could measure the amount of oxygen in the air and say, oh yeah, we're down to 15% instead of 21%. Do you believe they had the right kind of instrumentation so they continuously could analyze what was going on and what the health was? Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yes, they did, and naturally they were connected to the outside world, you know. But back in the early 1990s, you know, they didn't have the internet. You know, they had emails between, you know, I know they had emails. But the outside world was helping them to some degree, making sure they don't kill themselves. But yet, a lot of levels were changing, and then they would do things. I forget what they would do. I think they had some kind of carbon dioxide scrubbers or something. But then they were ostracized pretty much by the press when they did have to let some of the oxygen in. But I think that was until after a year. I don't know. I'll have to go. Again, that was a long time ago since I read that. But they did good, you know. But it was run by a guy, one of these, I guess, billionaire types. And I think they ran into problems with him. You know, he was some kind of a character with, you know, whether or not this thing was 100% the way the people that were in there thought it was going to be, probably wasn't. You know, nothing's perfect, Dick.
Yeah, did Biosphere run once, or was it two separate missions? What did they do for entertainment? I'm having trouble believing they would sit on a couch and watch television. Were the people required to do all of the plowing and planting and whatever, and continuous agriculture all the time, and taking care of animals? And did they have refrigeration so that they could store the meat that maybe when an animal died? So I see a problem where after a month you could get awful bored. If in your normal lifestyle you've got continuous internet connection, your cell phone, you're tweeting people, you're watching television, you're talking to other people on the outside world. It sounds to me like they were awfully isolated. And I think after a while you could get kind of bored and a little bit depressed. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
I think a lot of that happened. They talk about that in the book. The problem, the relationship between all the people and everything. But it worked out for her. She married one of the guys, you know. So it worked out okay. Yeah, they did all the maintenance and take care of everything. Now, you know, it really wasn't pure as far as, you know, I mean, it wasn't a big sphere. You know, cut off light. They had light coming in, so you had light from the sun. Electricity was piped in. They thought about having these gigantic solar farms all over the place to try to produce electricity, and theoretically that would be, you know, if you were in space, that would be with you, and you know, you make your own electricity that way. So, you know, they were hooked into the main, so they were powered up by, I guess, Arizona Electric. Back to you there.
Eight people. How big was this thing, Paul? Was the structure itself, I'm talking about land area that it occupied, was it more than an acre? And even with perfect electricity coming from the outside and perfect sunlight getting through your greenhouse glass, I don't think you can sustain eight people with an acre of land. Eight people would take more like 8 acres. I can't believe this thing was that big. Roughly how much land area do you think it had, Paul? Over to you, KQLAW.
Yeah, you touched my mouth. memory, but I'm going to go 3.5 acres. Pretty sure it was 3.5. So it was it wasn't one building. It was a series of buildings interconnected with one another. So, like their living quarters, you know, I don't think they were open to the sun. You know, they had regular walls, you know. But the main area, they had glass, you know, these triangular pieces. And then, you know, it went up a couple of stories, and light would come through. And they had what they called the ocean with fish. And they even had a desert. They had bugs and stuff. I don't know. I'm sure it would have been done completely different. But, you know, this was actually developed and thought about in the late 1980s when it was under development.
If you're right, Paul, 3.5 acres and 8 human beings, those numbers don't come out right. As I see it, somebody misplaced some decimal places when it comes to the energy requirement for 8 living, breathing, working human beings. You can't get enough food and recyclable and whatever in 3.5 acres out of that. The numbers are not coming out right, as I see it. That's my first guess. Somebody doesn't realize the amount of energy required to maintain a human being. You and I get a hint about the number of tons of stuff that are brought up in the progress ships to maintain those people on the International Space Station. This was TechNet number 1623, and that was Space Report number 223. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. We're going to settle all these problems, it says here. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Would you volunteer for that biodome, Paul? I mean, John, you got it, John.
KC2WGB, absolutely not. No, I was told a long time ago, never volunteer. But thank you, gentlemen, Paul and Dick, great net, and we had some fun. And everybody enjoy the week, and we shall be back next Sunday if everything goes right. And we will solve all of these problems, and we'll have all of the answers next week. Yeah, free beer tomorrow. Gentlemen, 73, and have a great rest of the week. KC2WGB clear.
Hey, John, the whole system is rigged. You got it, Paul. K2RIW.
No, I don't want to hear politics. I hear enough of that without ham radio. How do you want to put the TV on it? 73, we'll be back next week to talk technical stuff. Real important stuff. Back to you.
Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system.
One good technical thing to think about for the rest of the week is all of the RF energy that we're radiating with all of the information that's being propagated. Just think about it. When it hits the end of the universe, it turns around and comes back. And we can listen to it again. Amazing.
Paul, who told you that when it hits the end, it's going to turn around? There is no wall out there. Anything that goes to the end is going to keep right on going, Paul. I mean, John.
Well, I believe in the spheres. So if there's the spheres, there has to be an end, you know? And all of those stars are fixed on those spheres, Dick. You've heard about that. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, that's what Ptolemy thought that was the way to go. But he's not in vogue anymore, John.
Well, that was in my time. The music of the spheres.